From jet engines to space rockets, telephones to computers, the world has seen spectacular change in the last 100 years, and the pace of progress is getting faster and faster. From electric cars to the metaverse, drone deliveries to climate solutions and genetic sequencing, we're investing in the companies that are not just changing the world today, but are also shaping the future. The Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Invest in progress. Capital at risk.
Hello and welcome to The Advice Show. I'm Jack Gilbert, the editor of NMA. Today we have a slightly new format. Two of our excellent reporters in the room to talk about some of the biggest stories that have happened in the past week. So, Julian, thanks for coming in.
Oh yeah, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I mean, I did tell you to come in, so you know, you obeyed my instructions.
See how the sausage is made.
Yeah, exactly. And Joe Stoner, welcome.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
It's your second NMA podcast?
Second NMA podcast, yeah. Getting the hang of it now, hopefully.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you did a good one a few weeks ago, didn't you?
I did, listen.
Yeah, it was good.
Thank you.
Well, thanks very much for joining us today. We've got some interesting stories to talk about the past week. The first one I wanted to ask was about Julian, because you went to Newport in Wales last Friday.
Yeah, Uskmouth, South Wales. It's beautiful, actually. I'm saying this to my colleagues. Perfect for a summer or spring holiday, but I wasn't there on holiday. I was there to meet Torsten Bell.
The pensions
on
minister.
Friday morning, yeah, the pensions minister, who was very interesting. Didn't have ages with him, but he gave us some pretty interesting things. As I suppose most people will have seen this week, the government are pretty strong and the mandation stuff. But we were talking largely about ISIS, and he told us, or revealed to us, that the cash ISA wasn't going to be scrapped.
Because this was followed earlier in the year, there were some reports.
Exactly, there were reports sort of January through to March, I suppose, about the cash ISA being scrapped, which even led to Hargreaves Lansdown, I believe, putting out a notice saying, fill your boots, and just to make it the most of the allowance.
Yeah, I think they put out something saying, like, you know, buy now while stocks last.
Yeah, exactly. Some sort of DFS advert, yeah. And but the government said on Friday that they weren't going to scrap the cash ISA. His language that he used to me on Friday morning was quite interesting. He said, obviously, I've got the transcript here. He says, obviously, within the ISA landscape, the UK is unusual in the amount of cash that is held within ISAs, even though they're important. And obviously, there is no question we're going to be continuing cash ISAs, but the volume of it is high and people in general could earn higher returns elsewhere. So obviously, they've been speaking to people in industry, as has been confirmed to us. And I think the emotion around cash ISAs meant that they were impossible for them to scrap. But I think there is no doubt that the government, if they get their way, will reduce that maximum allowance.
The £20,000 limit.
Which is £20,000, yeah. People have sort of lobbied the government for it to be as low as £3,000 or £4,000. The government, I think, would struggle to go that low. But, I mean, it could be halved.
Yeah. So after you did the report, I think the FT did a story on the weekend as well that said that the government are doing a review of ISAs.
Yeah,
like, that's just across the board, though, isn't
that's
it?
That's across the board,
not
yeah.
just cash ISAs.
And I think that stems from sort of when I started this job last year, the big topic at the time was the British ISA, which Jeremy Hunt tried to introduce, which most providers in the UK were pretty against. AJ Bell won't mind me saying that they lobbied pretty hard for that to not be brought in. And this government made the decision for the British ISA not to be brought in. And in their financial services paper last year, the government had said, or Labour had said at the time, before coming into power, that they wanted to simplify the ISA landscape. There are currently seven.
It's a lot of ISAs.
ISA vehicles, yeah.
All very similar.
Yeah. And quite confusing, I think, for people. When Gordon Brown introduced them, it was meant to be a simple product for people to invest in.
Yeah, it's a bit like pensions become more complicated.
Exactly.
As they've got older. Interesting, Julian. Well, I mean, it sounds like this ISA review is the big one to watch then, like as and when we get a consultation paper on that or there's more leaks or...
Yeah, no, I think so. And some people have suggested that the announcement around the consultation might be revealed in Rachel Reeves's forthcoming Mansion House speech, which is in July. Some other people have said that it could come before that, but I think the Treasury are preparing the ground for what is quite significant. And actually, ISAs do hold, they do cut through, actually, in terms of financial products, I think, to the general public. They're popular. That's why the government...
Oh, they're massively used by financial advisors.
Exactly. And I think that's ultimately why the government probably can't scrap cash ISAs.
Yeah. And I wanted to ask you, what was Torsten Bell like? How would you?
He was nice. Yeah, I think I've said before to colleagues, he's an incredibly clever man.
So he was Resolution Foundation CEO.
He was at Resolution Foundation,
and he actually understands pensions, which is pretty rare.
Does understand
for a pensions, minister.
But also interestingly, he became an MP last year for the first time, was sort of parachuted into a very safe Labour seat, and became a minister 6 months later. But he was a policy advisor in the Treasury in around 2010.
So knows his stuff.
So knows his stuff and sort of knows how it all works. And like I say, it's a clever individual, and I think is not afraid to take on the pension funds and pension industry figures. I saw him speak at PLSA in March, and he was quite bullish, actually. He was sort of getting asked about adequacy the whole time, which is the second stage of the pensions review.
Which is auto-enrollment thresholds.
Auto-enrollment, exactly. And he was very bullish against the sort of actuaries who are in the room saying, we're going to do this, you guys need to stop worrying, and is not afraid to take them on, which is interesting. And I think, like you say, he has a deep understanding of the pensions industry, which I don't think can always be said for pensions ministers, at least when they first come into the job.
100%. It's been a constant theme, Julian, for the last kind of five to 10 years. Really since Steve Webb was around. Well, and Ros Altman, I guess. But this wasn't the only bit of pensions kind of related news in the last few days, Julian, because we also got some big news this morning.
We did get some big news this morning that the government are, in conjunction with 17 pension funds, are promising to allocate at least 5% of their defined contribution funds into private market, domestic private markets.
So in 10% into
10% globally, but 5% of that 10%.
So 10% private markets.
Yeah, exactly. 5% at least 5%. Yeah, UK private markets. I mean, it was kind of interesting, mostly from the release. I think I counted the word voluntary 3 times in one of the releases. This is very much the pension schemes saying to the government, yeah, we'll do this, but you have to meet some of our conditions. So I've got some of the conditions here. They say that, well, we said the signatories highlighted that although private assets investment had improved in recent years, they still require critical enablers, that was their 2 words, to back their conviction in illiquid investments. These include a pipeline of UK investment opportunities, so the government needs to provide the infrastructure for them to invest in.
Yeah, makes sense.
The whole market shifting from an attitude of value to value over cost. So at the moment, pension funds basically sell to businesses like ours on the promise that they keep the costs down.
Yeah.
What the schemes are saying is that actually we should be advertising and selling to workplaces that will deliver the best returns for your customers.
Yeah, so they can charge more, basically.
Seems fair enough, yeah. And then a review of the charge cap, which comes back to that's currently 0.75%. Some people say that they want it at a percentile. And then a review of the prohibiting of bulk transfers when it's in the best interests of savers. So
switching members between corporate pension schemes. Interesting. So basically, the providers are basically saying, look, we'll do your 10% private markets allocation, but here are a bunch of things we want in return.
Exactly, exactly. And it's not exactly the mandation that I think the government does want. I mean, I mentioned the PLSA with Torsten Bell in March this year, but I was also at the PLSA conference in October last year in Liverpool, the one in March in Edinburgh, and Emma Reynolds was asked consistently about mandation, and both she, Rachel Reeves, and Torsten Bell have all refused to rule out mandation.
When you say mandation, you mean that if providers don't allocate enough to private markets,
yeah, exactly,
they get forced.
The government will force them to do so. And the government's argument is that the UK is, in fact, Torsten Bell told me that the UK is an outlier in terms of on a global scale. So Australian, Canadian, US pension funds all invest domestically on a way larger scale than UK pension funds do, which is fair enough. But figures from the pension funds say that's just not the stuff for us to invest in. And our ultimate responsibility is to the clients to give them the best returns possible.
Interesting. And Joe, I mean, you've been here with us a whole 4 months now.
Yeah, I think just about.
And you've got your first pension?
Yeah, it's very exciting.
Yeah. So what, your workplace pension with Citywire, so what do you think about this story?
I think it's interesting, kind of those points that Julian just rattles through, because if on the one hand Torsten Bell is going to be pretty strong and take on pension funds and the pension industry, I don't see necessarily how that aligns with what looks like a pretty good, I don't know, deal for pension providers.
I think also a big stumbling block will be the investment opportunities. As Julian noted, there are these LTAFs, these long-term asset funds, I think I'm getting that right, that are a relatively new innovation, a kind of semi-liquid fund designed to give access to private markets. They're relatively untested. They've only been around for a couple of years. They kind of had a quite quick regulatory process. There's them. There are other kind of initiatives like the British Business Bank. But like Julian, hearing from people that there just isn't enough. Mm. There isn't the infrastructure yet to match the kind of investment that you see in Canada or Australia.
It's quite cliched, I think, but plenty of people you speak to will say, I think both on the record and off the record, you just need to look at HS2 for the issues that the UK has at building stuff at the moment. Spades barely go in the ground for anything. And if you're going to invest in the UK, it's a slow return. Whereas if you go elsewhere, Norway, for instance, in Europe, the building regulations are far easier to get.
Yeah, I mean, the returns from HS2, they're going to be like, you know,
exactly.
People are going to be dead in the ground before
exactly,
they come forward,
yeah, exactly. Right? And then you also have practically daily stories about bits of HS2 getting cut off and then added back on. It's sort of a mess.
Yeah, so it's kind of a part of a bigger story of the government, like Rachel Reeves trying to take on planning reform.
I think so, yeah. And the reason I was at Uskmouth in South Wales was, I was explaining to Joe earlier, it's a disused coal mill that the government are, through the Wales LGPS scheme, are turning into a local government pension scheme, are turning into a power station to be part of the national grid.
Interesting. Interesting, Julian. Well, look, I mean, this sounds like an interesting story. It sounds like
a developing one as well, I think.
It's a lot of road to run, and I'm sure readers, you'll be hearing more about this story in the next few weeks as and when we get more information or Julian gets more exclusive interviews with pensions
all
ministers.
Of us. But I think, yeah, on this, I think it's definitely, in terms of pensions on a national scale, it's definitely the story of the next few months, I think, how the government sort of tackles and takes these pension funds on and whether they eventually do get to mandate investment.
Yeah, we shall see. And now, Julian, I want to change seats metaphorically and pass you the editor chairing role.
Yes, absolutely. So you two work together with Celine on an amazing story on private equity in the advice market. Some startling numbers. I mean, so 28% of investment advisors in the UK are now at companies backed by private equity. Much of it money from the US, and over the last year, 37% increase in assets under management through firms backed by private equity, $332.5 billion assets under management. I mean, Jack, the first question I wanted to ask you was sort of about how this process came about. How did you guys find all this data? How did you manage to write the story?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'll just jump back in a second, and I'm going to get Joe in to help talk about the process, because it was quite a long-winded process. But this is something we've done for a few years now, which is basically we've looked at all the advice firms that are backed by private equity in the UK. The number has now risen to 40 firms. And we've looked at their stats and then got a flavour of the market in terms of how much market share they have and how their figures in terms of advisor numbers, in terms of profit, in terms of AUM has changed over the past year, and then comes this kind of the snapshot. But Joe, yeah, I mean, you obviously very instrumental in the process of getting this over the line. It took many weeks of work.
Many
Can
weeks.
You tell me how we kind of went about things?
Yeah, so I think, as you mentioned, the kind of rising number of PE-backed firms means a bigger pool of data that we had to
more data sets together. To interrogate.
Exactly. And the FCA registers a help to begin with, because that can give advisor numbers.
It's a bloody pain, the FCA register.
It's a pain. I mean, it's great that they do it, but it is a bit of a pain. Yeah. And things get complicated when you start having to account for subsidiaries and with OpenWork, for example, trying to understand all the different kind of advice firms within it. And so what that meant ultimately was a lot of emailing, a lot of bugging people. So I'm grateful to every PR who kind of tolerated me when reaching out to them again and again. So a long process, but one that I think is definitely worthwhile, because what we've ended up with is a pretty comprehensive overview of the PE-backed market, and some of the results are super interesting.
They are super interesting. Yeah, I'd implore anyone to go and read it if you haven't already. Jack, what were some of the biggest deals that occurred last year?
Well, we had four new entrants to the leaderboard. We had OpenWork, which is this massive advice network, which has around 5,000 advisors. They got bought out by Bain Capital. We had Close Brothers Asset Management. They were bought out by Oak Tree Capital Management, and that was a scoop which Victoria Bell, our news hounds, managed to break. We also had Mattioli Woods, who are quite a big name in the advice wealth management space in the UK. They got taken private by Pollen Street. And there was a smaller deal for a Bristol advice firm called Clifton Asset Management. So we had four new entrants to the leaderboard, making the total of 40 firms. We also had we had activity of kind of bolt-on acquisitions of IFAs, which we kind of have every year, the PE advice firms buying up smaller firms. We had 129 deals, according to our count, Joe, which is up from 115 in the previous year. Which I guess shows there's still appetite for the market. The PE guys are still interested in the UK advice market. It's not gone away. I mean, we've written about many challenges facing the sector from, the FCA's Consumer Duty. FCA's got a consolidator review, which is going to be very important to this market. And then we've got other challenges like, advisors leaving, particularly younger advisors, challenges of markets. I mean, obviously, they've been fluctuating a lot. And also profitability. I mean, that was something that one of the big themes of this year, because of the 40 firms we looked at, the 40 firms we found, 19 of them made a loss before tax last year.
Yeah, half, basically.
Basically half. And I mean, a lot of these firms, the PE investors will look at EBITDA. Mm. But at the end of the day, half of these firms are loss-making.
Yeah.
And the PE guys, it's getting to a point where a lot of them want a return on the capital of investing.
They're not coming for a laugh, are they?
Exactly. So they're going to want to sell up the vehicles that they've bought and built.
What can I ask, Jack? Obviously, your impression from having been here for significantly longer than both Joe and I, but perhaps Joe, one for you as well. Your impressions. What is your impression about why initially US in particular private equity was interested in the UK advice market, and why it continues to be despite those issues with profitability that you mentioned there?
Well, I mean, I think from the US perspective, I mean, we have done some stuff with our US colleagues in the past. I think what they often say to us is that they've invested heavily in the RIA market in America, and they see the UK advice market as a cheaper alternative. They see it as, the there's valuations maybe lower. It's an easier pool for them to fish in. And also, I think with private equity, what you tend to find is that, they look for a market which has been underdeveloped in terms of private equity ownership. Mm. They'll find that market, they'll buy up a bunch of firms. And I think, the UK previously, like up till about 5 years ago, didn't have much of a presence of private equity in the advice market. Now the market is much more mature. Lots of these deals have happened. But there's still, there's still interest. I think there's still that hasn't gone away. There is still appetite amongst some of the PE firms. But as I said, the big question is what happens next in terms of, do these PE firms manage to turn these investments into, do they manage to exit them successfully?
Yeah. And I mean, there's a big debate, Joe, in the UK about sort of what it is to have a financial advisor. From your impression, what's the implication of a customer being part of a company that's owned by private equity? Does it make the advice worse, the product worse, or does it not matter?
Yeah, I think it would be hard to give a one-size-fits-all answer to that. I think often, the case would be for most clients that they have probably no idea if their financial advisor has been taken over by or invested in by a private equity firm. And private equity always has this reputation of kind of being vultures and kind of, racing to the bottom and sacrificing service for profit. Not that there's necessarily that much profit in our instance. But I think that's probably unfair, taken holistically, because within the firms on our list, there's a bunch of really great advice firms that are doing good work and delivering for clients. So yeah, that's a bit of a fudge of an answer, but I'd say, yeah, that to be determined.
To be determined, yeah. I mean, and the advisors working for private equity houses, or firms backed by private equity houses, has increased. What's the implication for advisors?
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the headlines we have now. There are 10,481 advisors working at firms that are owned or partially owned by private equity. I mean,
that's doubled in the last
yeah, mainly on the back of the Open Work deal and the others as well. I mean, I think you have a mixed bag of views from advisors. Okay. You know, I think it really depends, because if a firm sells up to private equity or one of the PE-backed consolidators, often the owners of the business, the owner managers, will get a payout, so they're happy. But their junior advisors who don't have equity don't get a payout. So that's, I think, often when we see the breakaway advisors, the junior advisors being moved firms and saying, well, actually, I'm not getting a payout, and B, things have changed a bit in terms of the investment proposition, the fees, the culture, whatever it is the ownership changes result in. The junior advisors, you know, they're mercenaries at the end of the day. Advisors can move firms pretty easily, can set up firms, or can jump ship. And I think, you know, we have seen, and we are seeing, a lot of movement from advisors between firms on the back of the consolidation train. So yeah, I mean, I think it's a mixed bag, and I think, you know, there's still a lot of
question marks. I suppose another final question maybe that I had on this was, the FCA are conducting their consolidator review at the moment with a large scope of this to do with private equity investment. One for both of you, but you might have different views on it. Where should they be looking, or what would the FCA be thinking at the moment? I'm sure they've been looking at this data that you guys so doggedly found.
Well, I hope so. I hope the FCA listened to the stories. Well, I mean, I think when the consolidator review was announced, again, Victoria Bell got the scoop on the questionnaire that was sent out to the consolidators, and the FCA specifically asks about ownership and offshore ownership structures, because most of the PE investment is structured through the Channel Islands and offshore, and also the debt that these businesses have accrued. And myself and Celine and Dan Grote, or Dan led the piece, but we did a big investigation into the debt levels of the PE consolidators.
It's quite startling, isn't it?
Yeah, all the consolidators generally, but mainly the PE ones. At the end of last year, we found £3.4 billion of debt was sitting on the balance sheets, most of it held offshore. And the FCA's questionnaire did look a little bit like they read our story, because they were asking very similar questions around these debt structures and how they were being shown. So I think that's a key focus for the FCA, around debt levels of the PE-backed consolidators, and how firms have plans to alleviate those debts, to pay them off. Mm. I think really, and I think that is the key part of the story, because with these debt levels so large at many of these firms, the only way they can pay these off is by sales. So all it's doing is kind of accelerating the need for the PE guys to sell up these vehicles they've got to pay up, and which can then get them a payout, but then also potentially pay off some of the debt, or at least the next PE investors come along and they.
But how much of these businesses have grown or made a profit in the time that they've owned them?
Well, I mean, it's a real mixed bag. We're seeing a lot of firms kind of stagnate in advisor numbers, deals kind of drying up at many firms. Quite a lot of growing pains, like the mid-sized firms kind of staying relatively flat.
They've sort of reached their ceiling a bit and can't go.
Maybe. I think it's, you know, there's various reasons why their growth has maybe tailed off a bit, but it's a definite trend we're seeing. And, you know, how you square the circle of these rising debt levels, kind of growth kind of flatlining, and the need for the PE guys to get a return at the end of the day, it's going to be a big question. So, yeah, I mean, what happens next is going to be key in terms of if there's some more kind of big mergers, or if more PE guys come in to replace the current ownership.
Yeah, and Joe, what's your sort of assessment of
the landscape?
Yeah, I think the interesting thing to look out for, as Jack kind of mentioned, is what's the kind of ongoing appetite for these firms, because, I mean, Selin made the point in the piece that, you know, a majority of the deals done took place between 2019 and 2021. The kind of typical private equity window over which they'd usually like to see a return on investment is 3 to 5 years. Because of that, we can expect to see a lot of these firms going out to market again for new investment. That's not always easy, as we're seeing with Shackleton at the moment. And so I think, yeah, with debt levels where they are, with the kind of profit
figures where they are, I think it'll be interesting to see that test of appetite.
Fantastic. Yeah, well, I look forward to further stories coming out about this.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm going to take back the editor chair and ask...
quite right.
Ask Joe about a story. Yeah, Julian, you have been dethroned your chairing position. But lastly, I wanted to ask Joe, you got a scoop out this morning, which was an interesting one. An advice firm in Leicester called Trust Financial Planning had its FCA permissions revoked. Can you tell us what has happened here?
I'll do my best because it's ever so slightly knotty. But I guess the overarching view is that, as you say, there's this Leicester-based firm, Trust Financial Planning, that's been around since 2002. And since 2002, it's been losing money. And to kind of stop that loss, it's been borrowing from clients. It's borrowed over £1 million in a couple of different ways. It issued, well, its founder and director, Dan Brittenden, issued something called a trust bond, which is basically just an off-balance sheet personal loan to himself. To raise that money, he went to his kind of Christian networks and got money from both clients and other people from the networks. And then to pay off those loans, he's raised money again from clients and again from Christians through preference shares. He's also lent money from the company directly. All in all...
Lots of loans, basically.
Lots of loans, not a lot of money being made. And basically, we're left now in 2025 with a pretty big pile of debt and a pretty... well, I'll take the FCA's view here, not credible repayment plan.
Which is what Dan Brittenden told you.
Which is what Dan Brittenden told me, yes.
And in Dan Brittenden's defence, I mean, what has he said in response to this?
Yeah, so I would say that Dan's been has been a great help in that he's been very willing to kind of set out his view on things and to kind of walk me through what's going on at the company. And his case is that, look, he accepts that the company was loss-making. He accepts that there was a conflict of interest in raising money to pay off debts from clients. And he says that the company isn't losing money the way it once was, and he plans to repay his investors, some of whom have been invested since the early noughties. He plans to repay them through having a more profitable company. And this is when it gets a little bit concerning, through sourcing new investment.
Right. Who's going to invest?
The plan is Christian networks, right. So tapping them again, but also at churches and Christian charities. Yeah. That's the plan.
Well, there are stories about attendances being up, so maybe that will help him. Yeah. He says in your story that between 2004 and 2018, drawing investment funds for the business from individuals who were also clients did represent a conflict of interest. How is this allowed to go on for so long?
Well, that's the big question, I think. So a whistleblower first contacted the FCA about trust in 2016. It wasn't until 2018 that the FCA first got in contact with trust. And then we're obviously, 9 years later in 2025, and only now has the regulator moved to deauthorise the firm. And so, I mean, it's not new. The levels of debt that trust has racked up are not new. They were around in 2018 when the FCA was having a look. So I think as some people have, I mean, some people in the comment section on the article have raised the question, why did it take this long? And I think, yeah, the FCA would do well to answer that question.
Interesting, Joe. Well, again, readers, I all urge you to have a look at Joe's excellent story.
It's brilliant, yeah, it's fascinating.
A chance to look at the site today. But on that note, I want to say thank you very much to Julian for joining me.
Oh yeah, thank you very much. I look forward to next time.
And Joe, also thank you very much for joining me as well.
My pleasure, thank
and
you.
And listeners, thank you very much for listening.
Back with normal service next week with Advisor Podcast.
100%.
From jet engines to space rockets, telephones to computers, the world has seen spectacular change in the last 100 years, and the pace of progress is getting faster and faster. From electric cars to the metaverse, drone deliveries to climate solutions and genetic sequencing, we're investing in the companies that are not just changing the world today, but are also shaping the future. The Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Invest in progress. Capital at risk.